an ancient thief, and he will look back at murderers, spies, and ball players, the untold story of the 1934 All-American Tour of Asia. Our presenter is the founder of Sabre's Asian Baseball Research Committee and won the Sporting News Sabre Baseball Research Award in 2005. He is also the author of the book Remembering Japanese Baseball, an oral history of the game. And how many of you attended the author's panel last night at Barnes & Noble? A lot of you did. Well, good for you. Because he was present on the panel, since he's the author of the book, Banzai, Big Brew. Please welcome from New York, Robert Fitz.
Nagasaki's breath billowed as he loitered outside Yomiuri Newspaper's Tokyo offices. The morning of February 22, 1935 was chilly, but that was good. Nobody would look twice in his bulky overcoat. Matsutara Shiriki, owner of the Yomiuri Newspaper, was late. Nagasaki strolled up and down the block, trying to remain inconspicuous. Finally, at 8:40 a.m., a black sedan cruised down the street. Nagasaki halted in front of the bulletin board at the building's entrance. He studied the announcements as a short, balding man with thick-framed glasses emerged from the car. As Shiriki began to climb the stairs into the building, Nagasaki strode forward, pulling a short samurai sword from beneath his coat. The blade flashed through the air, striking Shiriki's head. Bloody newspaper owner stumbled forward as Nagasaki fled. Later that day, Nagasaki walked into a local police station and gave a detailed confession. The primary reason for the assassination attempt? Shiriki had defiled the memory of the Meiji Emperor by allowing Babe Ruth and his team of American All-Stars to play in the stadium named the Ruler's Honor. 3 months earlier, nearly a half million Japanese had lined the streets of Tokyo to welcome the ballplayers to Japan. Ruth rode in the first open limousine. At 39, he had grown rotund, and just weeks before had agreed to part ways with the New York Yankees. But to the Japanese, he still remained the pinnacle of the baseball world. The rest of the All-American team followed. Lou Gehrig, Connie Mack, Jimmy Fox, Earl Haverhill, Charlie Gehringer, Lefty Gomez, Lefty O'Doul, and a gaggle of unknown stars. Only one player didn't seem to belong, a journeyman catcher with a .238 career batting average named Boberg. Although he's not an all-star caliber player, his off-the-field skills would explain his inclusion on the team. Boberg was a Princeton graduate and a Columbia Law School graduate with a gift for languages. He had already visited Japan in 1932. He would eventually become an operative in the OSS, the forerunner of the CIA. And many believe that this trip to Japan was his first mission as a spy. The pressing crowd produced the broad streets and narrow paths just wide enough for limousines to pass. Confetti and streamers fluttered down from multi-story office buildings, and thousands waved Japanese and American flags, cheering wildly. Banzai, Banzai Babe Ruth echoed through the neighborhood, reveling in the attention that would be enough, plucked flags from the crowd and stood in the back of the car, waving a Japanese flag in his left hand and an American in his right. Finally, the crowd couldn't contain itself and rushed into the streets and closer to the bay. Traffic stood still for hours as Ruth shook hands with the multitude. Ruth and his teammates stayed in Japan for a month, playing 18 games in 12 cities. But there was more at stake than sport. Japan and the United States were slipping towards war as the two countries vied for control over China and naval supremacy in the Pacific. Politically, Japan was in turmoil. In the 1880s to 1920s, Japan enjoyed a form of democracy. This period saw great strides in modernization, a flourishing in the arts, and close ties to the United States. Yet as Japan's power grew, so did its nationalism. A growing minority felt that Japan should take its place among the world powers by expanding its military and colonizing its neighbors. Ultranationalist societies began assassinating liberal politicians and members of the free press. By the early 1930s, the civilian government could no longer control elements of the military. In 1931, nationalist officers engineered the invasion of Manchuria and twice plotted to overthrow the civilian government. War between the United States and Japan seemed inevitable. Politicians on both sides of the Pacific hoped that the goodwill generated by the tour and the two nations' shared love of baseball could help cure the growing political differences. Many observers therefore considered the All-Stars' joyous reception significant. The New York Times, for example, wrote, "The Babe's big bulk today blotted out such unimportant things as international squabbles over oil and navies." Yet, not all Japanese wished the two nations reunited. Just 2 miles to the northwest of the parade, at the Imperial Japanese Army Academy, a group known as the Young Officers was planning a bloody coup d'etat that would an upheaval that would jeopardize the tour's success and put the players' lives at risk. In another section of Tokyo, Nagasaki and its ultra-nationalist War God Society met at their dojo. Their actions would tarnish the tour with bloodshed. The 1934 tour began not as a diplomatic mission, but as a publicity stunt to attract readers to the Yomiuri Shimbun. Matsutori Shoriki had purchased the financially troubled newspaper in 1924 and quickly turned it into Tokyo's third largest daily by increasing its entertainment sections. Shoriki believed he could bolster sales by sponsoring a team of Major League All-Stars headed by Babe Ruth and cover the event in his newspaper. Working closely with Satoru Suzuki, a sports writer who lived in New York for 10 years, and nationally batting champ Ducky O'Doul, Shoriki signed up the powerful 1934 squad. The tourists boarded the luxury liner Empress of Japan Vancouver on October 20th, and after a stop in Honolulu, arrived in Yokohama on November 2nd. Although American teachers had introduced baseball in 1872, Japan didn't have a professional league. To challenge the Americans, Shoriki brought together Japan's best amateur players to form the All-Nippon team. The team included 11 future members of the Japan Hall of Fame and numerous colorful personalities. Over the next 4 weeks, the All-Americans and All-Nippons traveled together throughout Japan, visiting the northern islands of Hokkaido, the industrial cities of Yokohama, Nagoya, and Osaka, the ancient capital of Kyoto, Kokura, the southern island of Kyushu, and of course, Tokyo. The tour began with 2 games in Tokyo's Meiji Jingu Stadium, where thousands camped overnight to secure the best general admission seats. It soon became apparent that fans did not come to root for their countrymen, but to watch the major leaguers, and especially Babe Ruth, hit home runs. The crowd followed the Babe's every move. A reporter stated, "The fans went crazy each time Ruth did anything, smiled, sneezed, or dropped the ball." One fan had a novel plan. He worked in a textile factory designing kimono and undergarment patterns. He would sit as close as possible to the field and study the Bambino's face. He would memorize every feature, every wrinkle. Then he would return to the factory and create a pattern of the Babe's face for a new line of Babe Ruth underwear. He would become rich, I'm certain. Next, the All-Americans traveled north. As they boarded a ferry across the straits to reach Hokkaido, officials handed each traveler a small map with 3 coastal areas circled in red. Large cursive writing proclaimed, "Photographing, sketching, surveying, recording, flying over this fortified zone without the authorization of the commanding officer of this fortress are strictly prohibited by order. The handout is no mere threat. Japan was paranoid about espionage, and officials even inspected Ruth during the trip to make sure he wasn't taking photographs. But neither the proscription nor the officials stopped Mo Berg. Defying the warning, Berg whipped out his camera and filmed the area. The teams played two games in the northern provinces, enduring bone-chilling winds and frosted fields. Once again, the Americans won comfortably. As the teams returned to Tokyo, two dozen army officers met in an isolated restaurant. Their purpose? To overthrow the Japanese government. The Great Depression hit rural Japan particularly hard, leading to widespread starvation. At the same time, trading companies known as Zaibatsu flourished with unstable markets and rampant inflation. The conspirators, led by Captain Koji Muranaka, belonged to the loosely organized Young Officers Movement. The young officers felt that Japan's government had betrayed its citizens by putting the interests of big business before the welfare of the populace. The group advocated violent overthrow of civilian rule, the declaration of martial law, and the emperor taking direct control of the government. The divine emperor, they believed, would end rural poverty by redistributing wealth and lead Japan to world prominence by conquering Asia. On November 27th, Japan's parliament would meet in a special session. Once the politicians had gathered, the young officers and the troops would attack the Diet Building, slaughter the civilian government, and seize power. Other sympathetic troops would battle loyalist regiments in the streets of Tokyo. No mention was made of Babe Ruth in the wall planners. But as the Imperial Hotel faced the Emperor's Palace, it was just a few blocks away from the Diet Building, the Saloon Red, Murnaka's plan put the Americans in the line of fire. Meanwhile, the ball club stayed in the Tokyo area for 10 days, playing six games, attending banquets, and visiting local tourist spots. The games were one-sided. The All-Americans won all six comfortably, scoring 60 runs while surrendering a dozen. But on November 20th, 17-year-old Japanese pitcher nearly conquered the All-Americans. Aided by the midday sun in the batter's eyes, Eiji Sawamura pitched the game of his life in the small town of Shizuoka at the foot of Mount Fuji. He recorded 11 straight outs, including the second strikeouts of Gehringer, Ruth, Garrett, and Fox, before the Bambino broke up his no-hitter. The shutout continued until Garrett homered in the seventh to give the Americans a 1-0 victory. Sawamura would become a national hero. Although the Japanese had not won, they showed that they are capable of conquering their opponents. The game would become a symbol of Japan's struggles against the West. Many Japanese felt that with enough fighting spirit and practice, their countrymen could surpass the major leaguers, just as they believed the military would surpass the Western powers. As years passed, the importance of the game grew, and Sawamura's stature increased as a symbol of Imperial Japan. By November 20th, Captain Koji Muranaka's plans to seize control of Japan were ready. The special session of Parliament would convene in 7 days. Knowing that previous coup attempts had been betrayed from the inside, Muranaka had kept his group of assassins small. But the captain had not scrutinized his followers closely enough. Suspicious of Muranaka, the commander of the military academy had instructed a cadet to infiltrate his group and expose his plans. The same day as Eiji Sawamura pitched his masterpiece, the Kempeitai, Japan's dreaded military police, arrested Muranaka and his conspirators. News of the plot would remain hidden until the Tokyo War Crimes Tribunal in 1946. Only a handful of men knew that bloodshed, revolt, and maybe even civil war had nearly disrupted the All-American Baseball Tour. Sorry, there's Muranaka in the stalls. Sawamura's near victory gave the all-Nippon confidence as his two teams embarked on an 8-day, 6-day jump into southern Japan. At Nagoya, the Japanese once again nearly upset the Americans, entering in the bottom of the eighth with a 5-3 lead, and only to lose on several costly managerial decisions. After the two close games, the all-Americans increased their focus and won the remaining six games with a combined 80-17 score. The November 16th game in Kokura provided one of the most enduring images of the tour. Driving rain turned the field to mud, prompting Ruth and others to play in rubber boots. At one point, they huddled under an umbrella while playing first game. Few, however, know the other interesting event that occurred that day. In the fifth inning, with bases loaded, a 3-0 count, and 5'1", 116-pound Shinji Hamasaki on the mound, the Babe stepped out of the batter's box and pointed to the outfield bleachers. Unlike his famed 1932 call shot, there was no doubt about it this time. And sure enough, the Sultan of SWAT crushed the next pitch over the right field wall and onto the roof of an adjacent building, shattering its clay roofing tiles. Throughout the tour, Mo Berg would leave his group to explore on his own. Wherever he went, he took numerous pictures. On November 29, Berg informed Connie Mack that he felt unwell and would miss the afternoon's game. Immediately after the team left from the Omiya ballpark, Berg dressed in a black kimono, combed his hair in a Japanese style, put on getup, which was the wooden sandals. It was just above freezing outside, so he probably slipped on an Inverness overcoat, concealed his 16mm movie camera beneath it, and quietly left the hotel. He headed southeast through Ginza to St. Luke's International Hospital, a tall structure with panoramic views of Tokyo. Pretending to visit the American ambassador's daughter, Berg took the elevator to the top floor and climbed the spiraling staircase to the top of St. Luke's 50-meter tall tower. There, he pulled out his movie camera and panned the skyline, holding the camera still in a group of factories to the west and again on the waterfront. To cap off the footage, he focused on Mount Fuji, just visible on the southwest horizon. And these, of course, are Mo Berg's original films. During World War II, Berg became a spy for the OSS. He was even sent on a mission to assassinate Werner Heisenberg, the leading German physicist, if he had evidence that Heisenberg was close to creating an atomic weapon. Many believe that this trip to Japan was Berg's first mission as a spy. But in truth, there is no evidence to support this claim other than Berg's bizarre behavior. Personally, I believe the trip was pivotal. Personally, I believe the trip was a pivotal point in Berg's espionage career, but not because it was his first mission. It was because it sowed the seeds for his future career as a spy. It was while shooting clandestine films in Japan for the thrill of it that Berg realized his true calling. On December 2nd, thousands of flag-waving fans crowded into Tokyo's Ueno Station to bid adieu. "Goodbye, goodbye," he shouted as Ruth sniffled and yelled, "Sayonara, sayonara, banzai Japan." April wept openly, while Garrick yelled, "See you again soon." As the train ready for departure, the crowd quieted to hear Ruth's final speech. "I don't know how to show my appreciation, but if I have a chance, I will come back." The train took the players to Kobe, they boarded the Empress of Canada, stopped briefly in Shanghai for the game against local All-Stars, before finishing the tour with three games in Manila. The success of the 34 tour surprised American observers. Connie Mack found the Japanese crazy about the great national game of America. Capitalizing on the tour's success, Shiriki kept the All-Nippon team intact and organized the Nippon Professional Baseball League. Shiriki's squad renamed the Tokyo Yomiuri Giants, barnstormed North America in 1935 and 36, and went on to dominate the Japanese league for decades. As the All-Americans left Japan, Americans and modern Japanese proclaimed the goodwill tour a diplomatic success. Connie Mack summed up the consensus that the trip did more for the better understanding between Japanese and Americans than all the diplomatic exchanges ever accomplished, and assured listeners there would be no war between the United States and Japan. The Sporting News added, "We believe the recent trip to the Orient of baseball's finest has served to delay, if not prevent, any possible conflict. We like to believe that countries having a common interest in a great sport would rather fight it out on the diamond than on the battlefield." It didn't take long, however, for that feeling to vanish. Several weeks after the ballplayers departed on the Empress of Canada, Japan pulled out of the Washington Naval Treaty, which had limited the size of the major powers' navies. 2 months later, Nagasaki attacked Shiriki. Details of Captain Koji Muranaka's failed coup were not made public, but a military tribunal held in March 1935 let the rebels off with a 6-month suspension from active duty. A year later, on February 22, 1936, Muranaka joined with 23 other young officers in a violent rebellion that assassinated several high-ranking government officials and narrowly missed the Prime Minister. Rival military units crushed the rebels and arrested its leaders. 19, including Muranaka, were executed. Despite the coup's failure, the events led to a series of civilian governments more sympathetic to the military's nationalist agenda. In July 1937, Japan invaded China. Whatever hope there had been for reconciling the United States and Japan vanished. Ultimately, the two countries' love for baseball could not overcome Japan's desire for regional dominance. During the war, the military seized control of professional baseball. Fascists outlawed English baseball terms and redesigned uniforms to imitate military styles. Many members of the All-Nippon team served in the military, and several, including Eiji Sawamura, lost their lives. Yet the goodwill tour was not a complete failure. Several of the friendships cemented during the 1934 visit survived the war and helped reconcile two nations. Lefty O'Doul, who remained close to both Shiriki and Satoru Suzuki, traveled to Japan on his own expense in 1946 to renew the friendships and help restart Japanese baseball. 3 years later, O'Doul organized the first of several tours held during the Allied occupation. Once again, baseball was used as a diplomatic tool to help bring the nations closer together, but this time with lasting success. Thanks. Yes. Was there any evidence that the films used during the tour by Oberg were used during the Doolittle raid? They had these films at the time. Berg gave the films to the U.S. government, and they were previewed by the military. The Doolittle raid was probably used better information. They had a naval officer over there in the early 1940s. And his job was to gather all the information, films, and maps as possible for the upcoming war, because there was no secret there was going to be a war. So it's possible that they looked at Berg's films. They probably did. How useful they would have been, I don't know. You saw the clarity of them. So maybe not as useful as Myth of Attalus.
Did anyone else know Omar was a spy? I mean, he wasn't that really good player. How did he get from the trip?
Well, of course, he didn't become a spy until World War II. The reason he came on the trip was in 1932, there was a teaching tour of Japan, and three players went over, and one was the pitcher, Ted Lyons. Ted Lyons' roommate and best friend was Mo Berg. And he said, "Hey, Mo, you want to come over with me?" And of course, Mo Berg, being the language person that he was, said, "Of course I do." And he was a pretty darn good defensive catcher. So he went over to 30 tour, he taught some of the colleges with Ted Lyons, and he fell in love with Japan, the Japanese fell in love with him. And so when they needed a backup catcher at the last minute, they asked him over to join him. And Berg said, "Yeah, I'll go over again." And that's the real reason why he was there.
You said you
were
the backup catcher. Who was the regular catcher? I guess how much did Berg actually
play on that? The regular catcher was supposed to be Rick Farrell. He got sick or injured, I don't remember what. Then it was supposed to be Charlie Berry of the Athletics, but he got appendicitis on the train out there. So they had to fly a rookie named Frankie Hayes out there. It was a transatlantic flight, cross-country flight, and which was very rare at the time, and they got him just in time for the ship to go. And so Hayes caught almost all the games. Bird couldn't hit Japanese pitching worth a darn.
Any further questions?
You had a photo of Babe Ruth playing first base. Did he and Gary alternate? Did we play in the outfield, or where did Gary play?
Ruth was really out of shape. He just finished the 34th season. He wasn't sure what he was going to do with 35. He knew he wasn't going back to the Yankees, and he didn't really feel like playing the outfield. So he played first base and moved Gehrig, who was far younger, into the outfield.
Public address in that game.
Why did they play that game in the rain?
It was the only game scheduled for Southern Japan, and they came in, and you saw the conditions. He said there was no outfield bleachers. It was just a little slope. Apparently, it was almost a foot underwater, and there were fans sitting down in it waiting for them an hour or two before the game started. The story is Ruth, who was actually the manager during this, Connie Mack was not the manager. Ruth apparently told the team, if they can sit in that, I can play baseball in that, let's go. And Ruth's attitude throughout the whole tour was like that. He kept on saying, you know, I don't care if it's 10 degrees out there, there's snow there. We are in Japan to show Major League Baseball, we're going to play, stop grumbling.
Did they play any games in the field now called Jinku Stadium?
Jinku Stadium is the famous stadium in Tokyo. Yes, they played a lot of games, including the opening two games. The films you saw of the fans during my presentation was all Jinku Stadium taken during that tour.
What was Connie Mack's role on the tour?
Connie Mack helped organize the tour. And he was sent over by Landis as kind of to keep an eye on these fellows. This was a big event. I mean, the tension, I like to say, is that it's like the tension we have with Iran right now. You don't want to do anything wrong. It was really like walking on pins and needles. So Landis was talking to people, probably in the State Department. They said, you can't vote this. So Connie Mack is there to make sure everything went well. But Ruth was the field skipper, and Mack apparently had his eye on Ruth to see how he would do, possibly considering Ruth to manage the athletics for the coming season.
Any other questions?
Thanks very much.